Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest episode of The Interviews. And if you are a fan of period dramas about people living beyond their means, then boy, are you in for a treat this week, as our guests are from two very different films that are nevertheless about that very thing. First up, Savage House, the new film from writer-director Peter Glanz, tells the fictional story of Lord and Lady Savage, played by Richard E. Grant and Claire Foy, who are an 18th century couple who are greedy, grasping, grotesque figures who are down on their luck, but who suddenly receive something of a lifeline when they are invited to host a Duke and Duchess for dinner. Let's just say that the preparations do not go well, complicated by the odd helping of madness and murder. This is an unrelentingly grim black comedy in which terrible things happen to terrible people, and because that's a genre I enjoy, I was tickled immensely by it, not least because of the wonderful cinematography, the acerbic script, and cracking performances from Grant and Foy as a couple who, well, deserve each other. I sat down with them yesterday, Thursday, which is why this is out today on a Friday, in a London hotel room, a very well-appointed London hotel room, and had a lovely chat with him about this somewhat scabrous slice of cinema. Now, I didn't expect one thing to come up during the interview, but it did. One of the characters played by Grant and Foy is seen at one point engaging in a rather unusual sex act, and that is discussed. So, forewarned is forearmed, or forearsed in this case. Anyway, enough about that. Here we are. Two of our finest actors, and me, a bloke in a TK Maxx polo shirt. Enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Emperor podcast by Richard E. Grant and Claire Foy, stars of Savage House. I'm so sorry I'm underdressed. I feel like I should have had a three-piece suit. Richard, you are judging me.
I am, yeah.
Yes.
Because Lou told me how to get dressed.
I feel like I've let the side down, so I'm sorry.
You haven't.
Richard, you're really judging me, I can tell.
Yes, he's terrible. Yeah. He's in character.
Yeah, is Chauncey still with you?
No.
No?
No, long gone.
Okay.
No, I'm not a method actor, so.
Okay.
And nor is Claire.
Okay.
So as soon as it's wrap, you know, end of the day, it's finished.
Even that's when action is called, do you both jettison characters and immediately assume yourselves again?
I feel like, not in certain scenes.
Yeah.
But I feel like we'd quite often continue the conversation we were having before we started. They started saying action.
Yeah.
So blah, 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 blah. Action.
Acting.
Acting,
yeah.
Cut.
Yeah. That's the whole point of it.
Yeah. But have you tried the method? Have you tried going down that road in the past?
No. I've never wanted to.
Okay.
I'm not judgmental or decry people who are brilliant method actors.
Yes.
It's just not something that... my mental health is fragile enough with putting myself down in the dungeon of, you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Taking the characters.
Especially with Lord and Lady Savage in this movie.
That would be a bleak few months if you were in character for that.
It really would. Because I had a hoot watching these guys because they are utterly grotesque and they are sowing the seeds of their own downfall. I don't think that's too much to say.
Absolutely.
And I had a great time watching them. But they're horrible, horrible people. Now, I speak to a lot of actors over the years, and they always say they look for the good in their characters, even if they're playing out-and-out villains.
Yeah.
Is it hard with characters like Lord and Lady Savage?
No, I absolutely loved them.
Yeah.
I thought they were absolutely brilliant. Yeah,
they have such huge appetites for everything. Each other, shagging, food... Everything that's going on, and I think that, you know, they grab
sometimes food and shagging at the same time.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yes, quite often. In Chauncey's case, I don't find them. I mean, they're obviously, like you say, grotesque.
Yes,
but I think it's. I don't know whether it's so much about finding the good. I think it's just the understanding why people are the way they are.
Yeah.
And acting is like a really fortunate profession for that. Like that, you sort of have an understanding of humanity in a way. Which is that there is a reason for everyone's behaviour.
Yes.
And that doesn't necessarily make them a good person or negate it, but there is a reason. And that's sort of the actor's job to find out what that is.
Yeah, the moment you understand somebody, then you can have compassion for them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And does that process of understanding begin
at the screenplay stage, when you read them for the first time, you go, oh, I think I know what makes this person tick. Richard, we'll start with,
yeah,
with you.
Yeah, completely, because until you have the screenplay, there is nothing else to go on.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely the blueprint that gives you absolutely everything.
Mm.
And then as soon as the other people are cast around the character that you're playing, that also informs a huge amount.
Mm. Yeah.
Of how what the world is that the director or writer, in this case Peter Glantz, is creating.
Yes, yes. And Claire, what does it start for you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I read I know when I read something if it's something that I should or want to do.
Okay.
But I don't necessarily know how to do it. It's not like I know, oh, I understand that part of myself through that person necessarily. Yeah. Sometimes it can be like a really giant leap and I've got to figure out how to combine those two things, which is sort of how I think and who I am with how they think and who mm-hmm. they are, to try and understand. Because sometimes it does feel ginormous, like that difference. And other times it's totally like you read it and you go, oh my God, I get everything.
Yeah.
But I enjoy both challenges, I suppose. And sometimes it is just, sometimes I just cannot see myself playing it at all. And that's a real mystery. And only until the end and like wrapping it, do I feel like I've gone through the journey of them or the experience. And then I'm like, oh, okay, now I get it.
Okay.
But it doesn't necessarily have to be like that.
Was this a ginormous leap for you?
I suppose, I think that the period element and I think the comedy element of like making them authentic, but also ridiculous was easy, but you had to watch yourself. I feel like we had to check ourselves quite often mm-hmm. to make sure that we were still keeping the thread of like the being honest about who they are, but not being like a total ham. So sometimes I'm total ham, but then
you're
other
never total ham.
No, but there has to you're be an element of ham because they're hammy. They are hammy. They're sort of they're as people. They are large. They're huge characters.
Yeah.
And so there has to be an. And also, it's not as fun if you don't.
Yes.
But also, I think it's just like embedding it with the authenticity of like
yes,
who what their vulnerabilities are, what their kind of what they want. Why they care so much about the Duke and Duchess of Bloody Devonshire. Like, why is it so important? Because, you know, to a modern audience, it's like, is that, there are just some people coming for dinner, but for them, it's like, oh my God.
It's everything.
This will change our lives.
Yes.
Yeah, but if you said to people in the middle of nowhere,
the Queen's
Beyonce is coming for dinner, people may, or whoever, somebody that people held in some esteem, then it makes people crazed.
Yeah.
Crazed, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much so. And it's interesting, I mean, because they are characters that, as we said, are grotesque. And the instinct to ham it up must have been there for both of you. Richard, in the past, you have not been averse to a little bit of hamming it up. that's a compliment, sir. I remember, I still love the moment in Hudson Hawk where you jump on the table and yell, "World domination," and you put your hands out like that. Now, that wasn't underplaying it, sir, I would say. So how do you avoid that with a character like Chauncey? But at the same time, you have these incredible scenes where you're really giving it your all.
Well, he is a man of enormous appetite and enormous extremes. So when you arrive on the set and you see these huge wigs and the makeup that you have to wear and these extravagant costumes, you can't go at it half-heartedly because I think that it would fail. So you've got to go at it full tilt, or that's what it seems to me. But he absolutely believes what he's doing is for his own social advancement or shaggery. And you know, he absolutely believes that's the thing to do. And if somebody really believes in what they're doing, I think you can go to any extreme.
Because there's a scene, you have a meltdown when you're posing for a portrait. I don't want to spoil too much about the movie, but that was
well, the character's suffering from extreme gout, so that's affected his mind, is in agony. And the thought that this whole social construct of welcoming these aristocrats for dinner is falling apart, that he's losing his grip, makes him, you know, go do lally.
I love it when actors really, you know, swing for the fences, as they say, you know when Richard is doing it in Hudson Hawk, Nick Cage, for example, people like that. Claire, are you drawn to performances like that? Is that something that appeals to you, larger than life performances?
Yeah, I mean, well? I'm sort of jealous. I don't ever get to.
You did get your bum licked.
I did get my bum licked, so that's my reach.
I wasn't sure we were going to bring that up in the presence of a lady, but okay.
Yeah, no, I think that I
it's my favourite line of the film.
I think that's what you sort of get. I think that's the most enjoyable thing to watch as an audience, is watching someone really do it.
Yeah.
And that's not my gift in life. I think it could in my actual life it probably is, but I think that on screen it certainly isn't. So I have to sort of stay in my lane, I think. But this one, this film was my attempt, and I got my bum licked, and that's what happens when you try.
Sadly, not me doing that with Jack Farthing's.
That's a moment in the script that takes you by surprise, I'm guessing, as well, when you're so reading that for the first time. Is that the moment, okay, I'm on the fence about this movie, but now I'm in.
What's that? I mean, it's just so funny. I just think it's so, like, people do it.
Yeah.
Just saying. And so I loved that idea that you were seeing someone. It was that iteration. It was the lady of the house and the... my husband's manservant.
Yes.
And that was how that was happening. What was also having a conversation. I just love the setup of it.
I
was convinced it wasn't going to end up in the film. I was
really?
I can't put that in the film. It's too much. But there it is.
It's very, very tastefully done.
Isn't it?
Although the sound effects are hilarious.
Lip smacking.
Honestly.
Richard, you pulled a face there when Claire said, everyone, you know, people do it. Not everyone does it, but people do it. And you pulled a face as if to say, you this is something that's new for you, this idea of bum licking.
Now, I'm going to step in here. Do you want to talk about this?
Richard, this is a door you opened. So,
a door I opened.
With your
you opened
this apparently.
Door. You introduced to bum licking.
It's
now,
in the film.
Here we are.
I have so far, at the age of 69, not done any bum licking. But that's not to say that I won't, because I am like the Ken Barbie, just a sort of plastic hump down below.
I think we need to move very swiftly away from the bum.
The actor who famously played the late Queen of England has a bit of the old.
Shall I ask you one of my serious questions?
Yes.
Come on,
all right, I'm going to try and couch this somehow. But the savages in this movie are people who are, I think, suffering from a great deal of panic about their social status, of course, about their class status. They suffer from imposter syndrome. They're trying desperately to fit in with society. Chauncey's changed his name, of course. Is that something that both of you could relate to in a way as actors and as people trying to fit in with the world around you?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, you do, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I grew up in the Southern Hemisphere in Africa and... Yeah, came to England.
You changed your name. There's
inevitably that feeling of always being an outsider looking in.
Yeah.
And that doesn't go away.
Yeah.
Entirely.
So does that fuel the performance?
Yeah.
In a way.
You understand why that wanting to fit in and to be taken, you know, as one of the natives.
And Claire, you said no.
I think I said no because I think I feel, I suppose, anytime I feel outside of something in life.
Mm-hmm.
This hasn't always been true, but I definitely don't. I feel a need to hold on to what I know to be the truth or what I am, as opposed to trying to reach to where those people are. Instead of like, for this industry, for example, sometimes can feel very much like there's a group of people and then there's a group of other people and then there's a group of, you know, there's runs or there's spheres that you can't enter or that you should feel like you're part of or you shouldn't feel like you're part of. And I suppose that's my only experience of it in a way is that if you ever get on the inside, you don't really want to be in the middle of it. You don't, from
you feel
the inside.
You are on the inside.
No, but if you ever have, you know, certain things that you've gone to or things like that, that actually it devalues it. And I never want to actually attain that. I want to actually keep
yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I certainly wouldn't do what they do. In lots of ways.
Yeah, on Instagram.
No, I'm not on Instagram. Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I can't.
Pure. Mm.
Not
pure foy.
Pure foy.
Pure foy.
Yeah.
That's a different person. Of course. But
it is.
It is, yeah.
James.
Yeah, James Purefoy. But, Richard, you are on social media, so you've very much embraced that side
of
things. I am,
but this is going to cause problems with Claire Foy,
so
please don't bring it up.
It's not going to cause problems. Why do you say that?
Here
I don't.
Go. It's just...
There's no problem. I admire him.
Are you anti-social media?
I'm anti it in general, yeah.
Okay.
So please don't go there.
No, but that doesn't mean that I judge anyone. Like, I think what Richard does on... No, but what you do is positive.
Okay.
You're already putting positivity out there.
Hopefully.
Yeah. You're not doing horrible things and writing horrible things and being mean. Or are you?
No. I like my life too much.
That's the thing, Claire. If you're not on social media, how do you know?
Well,
you've got to get
lurk.
On social media. You lurk.
I
lurk.
Oh, you
do yeah. lurk. I yeah. lurk. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do you have a burner account? Or any of these? An account under a completely different name so people don't know it's you. And then you can lurk more successfully.
You can't get in otherwise. Yeah. You have to have some sort of weird system.
So that's like stalking.
No, because no one... That's not stalking because everyone else on Instagram is stalking.
Oh.
Claire, I believe at one point you were thinking about becoming a cinematographer. Is that correct? Or is that absolute nonsense on the internet?
No, I was.
Okay.
But in a very loose way. Because I didn't know how I wanted to... I did film at university and I didn't like editing and I didn't like, I couldn't really understand directing. It was too much. What I did like was how pretty it all looked and making it pretty and like putting the camera in different places and things like that. And so I did briefly think about going and doing cinematography, but there was only one course in the UK and they only ever took 6 men a year. And it was about being, I loved films, them. And just, it was about learning how do you do that? And really, I just want to probably be in them. Because I'd be a terrible cinematographer. I'd just be like this on people's faces all the time. It'd just be like a single eye. You'd never see any, the only thing you'd see is skies and people's faces.
I think looking like you do, it would have been pretty fast that somebody said, no, you should be in front of the camera rather than behind it.
Oh, I don't think so.
Yeah, I do.
So very quickly, because we're being wrapped. In terms of that, this film is shot... You know, using a lot of natural light, a lot of candlelight, you know, very, very Barry Lyndon in that regard. What
Adriana
was it like
beyond the end? Adriana Goldman's DOP. Yeah.
What was it like beyond the other end of that?
Incredible. He's just so sensitive and thoughtful.
Yeah, it feels the opposite of Merchant Ivory, where everything is perfection and beautiful. All the kind of decadence and falling apart of this world is absolutely perfectly captured. And Gary Williamson's production design absolutely supports that.
Okay, that was Richard E. Grant and Claire Foy talking about Savage House. I had enormous fun talking to them, although I am still blushing about you know what. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed it. Savage House is out now in cinemas across the country. It is, as I said at the beginning of the show, a very different film from Kellen Jones's Mad Fabulous, although they do explore similar territory to an extent, although Mad Fabulous has the distinction of being based on a true story and a real-life figure, Lord Henry Cyril Paget, the 5th Marquess of Anglesey, who was an incredibly flamboyant figure who burned through his inheritance money faster than you could say Jack Robinson, and who lived fast, died young, and left a good-looking corpse at the turn of the 20th century. He is brought to life memorably in Mad Fabulous, a term which is used in the film to describe his approach to life, by the Welsh actor Callum Scott Howells, who shot to fame in It's a Sin a few years ago. I had a lovely chat on Zoom with Howells just the other day, and we talked about a great many things, including his approach to playing the character, how the film handles the subject of Henry's sexuality, and how Howells approached saying the film's title in a line of dialogue which comes towards the end of the film. We also talked about his origins as an actor playing Oliver in Oliver, which leads to a very surprising and I'm sure completely genuine offer to me. Here he is, Callum Scott Howells. Enjoy. Callum Scott Howells, star of Mad Fabulous. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
I was very tickled by the fact that you get to say the name of the film. You get to say Mad Fabulous.
I do, which was, you know, it can go one of two ways, I think. When I read her, I was a bit like, oh, I cringed a little bit, not at the writer, but at the, just at like the idea of saying it. It's just, because it's always like, you can't just like say the title of the film, right? It's not just like Mad Fabulous. There's the whole bit, and it's one of the, I think it's almost one of the last things I say.
Yeah.
If not the last.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, sorry.
That's my fault, I started it.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's the whole body of the film exists before it, and then But I really am, when I watch it back and I think about how we shot it, I'm really pleased with it. I think it's actually really sweet, and I really like it, yeah.
Was the film called Mad Fabulous when you signed on? So when you shot that day, you knew you were saying the title of the movie?
Yes, I can confirm it was always called Mad Fabulous, which, you know, as you probably know, that's not always the case where the film is the same title when it gets released. No. I actually had that was actually a thought I had. I was like, what if it ends up being called something different? But thankfully, they kept the title throughout.
Well, it's really fascinating because, yeah, it's true. You say this at the end of the movie, when Henry is looking back at his life. And I don't think it's a spoiler, though, Callum, because he's a real life guy. If you want to look him up on the internet, you can look him up, Lord Henry Paget. 5th Marquess of Anglesey, and you can look him up, and he led a life that I think is mad fabulous, and which is obviously a made up word, but it makes perfect sense in the context of the film. And at that point, it's really interesting because you imbue him saying that with a real sense of pride at the way he lived his life, which was unapologetically him, but also regret because things have not turned out that well for him. So it's an incredible load of emotion to pack into one portmanteau word. What was your approach to that? What were your discussions with the director, Kellen, about that?
Yeah, it was complicated. And I suppose that's the big sort of thing, that's the big sort of question that this film poses, I think, and obviously playing Henry himself, it was one that I had a big question hanging over my head, was that, you know, he lived, as you say, very unapologetically as him, and it was very extravagant, very entertaining, and very fun, I'd imagine, but it obviously came with kind of dire consequences, and one that had a lasting legacy on the family, even to this day. You know, it's sort of his name is certainly, I know, within the family, shrouded with controversy. However, you know, it is kind of a fact that people loved him. Yeah. People really did love him. And my personal feeling towards him is I feel like he just wasn't supported enough in that role and in that title. And I just think sort of he became a laughing stock, I feel. And then I think, you know, when someone feels like that, I think, you know, there's a sort of essence to like rebel, I feel, you know, against the establishment and, just to answer your question, that line I had to sort of to pack it in there, you know, there was a lot of that in it, but also, you know, I think he's so supported by the end of the film by the people that he loved.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, it's a complicated thing, I think, because yeah, even now I'm saying it, and I go like, well, gosh, yeah. I mean, he did, you know, he took advantage of people as well. So, it's constantly something I'm sort of pondering over. But I do think that Henry, you know, lived a life at like full throttle.
Before I started to watch the movie, I Googled him very, very quickly, and there's a Wikipedia page for him. And on the Wikipedia page is a picture that I think gives you a kind of indication of what he was like, which is just this incredible picture of him in an elaborate costume, incredible headgear that a glam rocker from the 70s would kill for. And he has his leg out in a very provocative manner. And, you know, this was at a time when anyone venturing outside the norms of society, of what, you know, quote unquote polite society at the time, was kind of ostracized. You know, you can look at this picture and you go, oh, I get this guy completely. But that's a surface level reading. How did you delve beyond that and get this guy who was many, many things, so multifaceted. He was a delight to be around, but he was also capricious and he was at times very testy. So how did you find your way into him?
Yeah, it's funny you say that because I looked at the images and on a first glance, I was sort of like so struck at, like first of all, like the fact that it was going on at the time it was going, like he was sort of he was wearing those clothes in the late 1800s, which is like so beyond, and you know, and the title that he had, it's so scandalous, it's brilliant. but I then also when I was sort of then thinking about portraying him, I had this like just huge, I had this huge thing about like what is going on underneath it. I was just sort of always thinking about if he is doing that, something must be going on there, right? He must be quite a complicated guy because, you know, as we know, like now, because of, you know, people that existed, I guess, after Henry, that when people have this kind of larger than life persona and they sort of present themselves in these extravagant looks, or they, you know, they publicly are sort of expressing themselves that way, we know that like these people are complicated creatures. Yeah. And that is the kind of beauty of humanity, right? It's that, and this is why we love these stories. So it was for me then, I wanted to get into the nitty gritty of why does he behave like this? And that was a big challenge, but I was particularly putting it on camera. You know, there's one thing to sort of do it on stage, which would be, you know, in itself a big feat, but then to really get into the nuance of it, putting it in front of a camera where it picks up the most minor of things that you do muscularly as an actor, it was a big one of the biggest challenges I've had in my short career so far.
And how did you and Kellen approach things like his sexuality, for example? He has this relationship with his wife Lily, played by Ruby Stokes, but there are also senses that he's attracted to men but never really acts on that. Was that something that you and Kellen talked about?
Yeah, a lot. I suppose the how we deal with it in the film is, but to a large extent, what I wanted to do with it. I feel really passionate about not imposing a sexuality on him, because we don't know. Like I didn't want it to be some sort of, you know, crazy sex scene where he's surrounded by a load of men, and neither did I want that with women, because we ultimately don't know about his sexual relationships, unfortunately, because I would have loved to have known how he conducted himself in those environments. However, we do know that the marriage was never consummated. That is something that was a largely known fact. So I wanted to sort of interrogate it, but I didn't want to sort of answer it in a way. I wanted to pose the question, but never. But then, you know, that's not to say that when we were shooting it and when we were sort of, I did have my own opinions and especially in those scenes with Nick, played by Tom Rhys-Harris, and Ruby also. You know, there's, and we say, we, you know, I suppose, you know, we can sort of argue whether he was gay or bisexual, but you know, let's not forget there's also asexuality on that spectrum as well, you know. So I'm not that's not me sort of saying that that's how he identified, but I just wanted to sort of, you know, flirt with the idea of him also maybe, you know, not wanting to pursue sexual relationships. So yeah, it's a very complicated question that the film poses, but it's one that is a tricky one to answer. But I did have I had a really interesting time exploring it as an actor.
Absolutely. I mean, the film starts, the very first line, we talked about one of the last lines, so we might as well talk about the first line as well, which is voiceover, and you say, as Henry, I was born a good story, which is a cracking line. Were you, Callum, born a good story?
Oh my gosh. I'd like to think so. and I'd like to think my parents would feel the same way. I suppose what I love about it is like when he says that, it's like sort of the idea that he's sort of like crashed down to earth as like an alien, and like he's sort of that's how I imagine him in the film. Like when he comes on that boat, it's like he's a creature from another planet arriving on Earth to sort of inflict his ways of being, and I sort of it's because I think the thing is with this film also, it's so fun. Like it's this idea of him coming into this sort of very sort of rigid establishment and sort of smashing it up. It was I really enjoyed that aspect of it, you know, with all the sort of people like, you know, Paul Reiser's Penryn, etc. But yeah, was I Born a Good Story? Why not?
Where would it start if we were doing the Callum Scott Howell's biopic? Where would it start?
Well, I think I came out apparently, and I was told that I didn't cry, which is always quite an interesting thing. I'd like to think I was kicking and screaming from the off, but apparently I was very quiet, which is hilarious now when I think about what I do for a living.
Yeah, cry at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, well, exactly. You know what? Funny you say that. I cry at everything nowadays.
Yeah.
I went to see a play the other night and a film. And I sobbed at both. And I don't know what it is. Like, as I get older, I'm 27 now. And as I get older, I'm like, oh my gosh, like, what's going on? I'm like, I haven't even had kids yet. God, they're not going to be like that.
You know, it's called, and this is great for an actor to have, it's called empathy. And you're full of it. You know,
yeah,
so.
I think so.
It's a beautiful thing. What was the film and what was the play? What made you?
So I saw a play at the Donmar Warehouse called Mass.
Okay. Oh my God. Based on the film? About the mass shooting?
I think so.
Yeah, it's a film first. It was a film first.
Really?
Yeah,
right,
it's fantastic.
Right. So it's based on a school shooting that occurs and with Adil Akhtar in it, and Paul Hilton and Monica Dolan, who I am huge fans of the three of them, particularly Paul Hilton, who went to my drama school, and it is. I can't tell you how earth-shatteringly devastating it is. I came out and I had to sort of, I had to go for a walk because I was just so affected by it. I was particularly shocked at how I felt about the perpetrator's parents. I had so much empathy for them, and this play is just beyond. So I saw that. And the film, what was the film I watched? I can't even remember.
you're crying at anything these days.
I cry at anything. What was the film? It was American Beauty. I think I just was so struck by just how brilliant the film was in that respect. Mass was very special.
While we're talking about theatre and we're talking about acting on stage, I want to talk about what you're doing next, obviously, which is Amadeus with Michael Sheen, which is amazing. But first, I wanted to talk very quickly about one of the things you did first, which is you were Oliver in Oliver. Now, Callum, I was Fagin in Oliver in my high school play, and I fucking sucked. But I nearly said rock there, but I've got to be honest. How were you as Oliver, and what do you remember of it?
I'm sort of gutted. In a parallel universe, you could have been the Fagin to my Oliver, and that would have been so much fun.
We'd be reviewing the situation.
We would be reviewing the situation, and I'd be trying to pick your pocket or two. I'd like to think I was brilliant, but you know, in a way, I don't. this sounds sort of crass, but I don't care. Like, I think my mother says I was great, but I just, all I remember selfishly is how falling in love with being an actor, like the thought of being an actor, or even that would have been, I was 11 years old, and, you know, I at that point, I would never have even known what was going to come, obviously.
Yeah.
But there was just this sort of magic to having an audience right there and like singing Where Is Love, you know, or Please Sir, Can I Have Some More? And then, you know, having the audience sort of be like, oh, you know, and it's nothing beats it. And even though, like with films, there's not that sort of live element to it, I still enjoyed like when you do screenings of stuff and you can hear people, you know, react to things. And it's just, you can never be a live audience and how they react to a piece. It's just the best feeling in the world. And I, even at that sort of young age, it was just something that I'm addicted to it, really, I suppose.
Which I guess is one of the reasons why you're heading back to the stage to do Amadeus with Michael Sheen, which will be amazing.
Yes, and also I'm sort of terrified as well. I never it always amazes me how nerve-wracking it is. That first night is just like I'm always so ill the days after the opening night, because the day of the opening, I wake up and I wish I could just wake up and I wake up side of stage. The day beforehand, before the show, is always like so rubbish. It's just like such a waste of a day, because you just go about your day going, oh my God, I've got the thing tonight. And then you do it and it's always so much fun, but it's just like so nerve-wracking, but also so brilliant. And yeah, I suppose that's the beast of it, right? Is it? Yeah. It's like trying to wrestle this kind of crazy thing and sort of try and like lock it in. That's what it's like doing theatre. And I'll always put myself through it, but boy, does it always shock me how nerve-wracking it is.
So if people book tickets now and they've got tickets for, say, the second night, there's a chance you might not be there because you might be sick.
No, I'll be there, but I'll be pale as a ghost, spewing in between every scene.
Tonight, the role of Mozart will be played by Callum Scott-Howell's understudy.
I'm very excited for Amadeus, though. It's a role I've wanted to play for a very long time. I love the play. It's so beyond, it's for me, it's like the sort of pinnacle of the theatrical experience, that play, because it just stretches everything. You know, it's so brilliant. It's about these two men, but also it's about this kind of like massive thing, and that's music, and the music, the experience of music, and what that does to us, and what it is capable of. I'm very excited to put it on stage.
And of course, it'll be another kind of mad, fabulous role for you, because Mozart was not someone who hid his light under a bushel.
Yes, it certainly. I sort of like the idea that, again, that he's like this like meteorite, like sort of crashing down to earth, and he's got this kind of like this fusion inside, this fission, nuclear fission inside him, that's like always on.
Yeah.
And sometimes he can sort of tackle it, but a lot of the times he can't. And I love that thought. Mm-hmm. So I'm very, very excited to portray him. I mean, talking again about someone who smashes the rule book up.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm right now listening to his music a lot every day, basically. And I just, every time I listen to his music, he just always does something that shocks me. I was actually talking about his piece Così Fan Tutte the other day, and it's sort of very like, sort of, it's very like lighthearted, and then there's this song that comes in, and it's so operatic, and it just breaks your heart. And yeah, and that's what he does all the time. When you think one thing's one thing, he always comes in and goes, ah, but what about this? And yeah, I love him. And, you know, I'm very excited and honored to be portraying him on stage.
I'm excited. I'm, yep, consider me sold. Two tickets right here. Thank you very much indeed.
But will you come on stage and be Fagin?
Yes, I will do that. I will send people racing for the exits when I come on.
Well, funnily enough, like Henry would do his butterfly dance in the intervals of his plays in Mad Fabulous, you could maybe come on and do reviewing the situation in the interval.
Because plays don't do this, and they should do this. You know, you have the halftime, big performance at the Super Bowl, right?
Yeah.
So they should do this in plays.
So we get Chris Hewitt coming on as Fagin.
Yeah.
As our halftime Super Bowl performance.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm there. I mean, I remember most of the lyrics to review in this situation, so I'm there.
Consider it done. I'll see you on the 29th of April on the Noel Coward stage.
All right, fantastic. I'll book it in. Brilliant. Callum, on that note, I'm going to let you go.
Thanks, Chris. Lovely to speak to you.
Okay, that was Callum Scott-Howells talking about Mad Fabulous, which is in cinemas right now. And if you want to see Amadeus on the West End stage, then tickets for that are also on sale right now. It'll be playing at the Noel Coward Theatre next year. Obviously, the night that I'm due to appear during the interval as Fagin singing, reviewing the situation, those are almost certainly sold out. Sorry about that. Right, that's enough for me. I am very much reviewing the situation right now. In fact, I think I better think it out again. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.